Okay, I think most people are here, so we can start the final talk of this meditation retreat, what I call the last rites, where we give the eulogies of what a wonderful retreat this was, and how sad it is that it's all leaving. I expect that when we depart at 1:45 or 2 o'clock, that you are crying and sobbing as you leave this place, thinking, oh, what a shame, it's all finished. And that you are weeping and almost inconsolable in your grief that the retreat is finished. However, sometimes I don't think that's going to be the case. But nevertheless, it's always the last talk of the retreat where you wrap things up, and also that you give some guidance for how to carry on this process of meditation, letting go, insight, happiness, into the future when you go back to your different residences. So during this retreat, you've obviously heard me say many times about how this path of meditation is learning how to let go, no controlling, learn to be at peace, and to enjoy some of the results of that attitude of mind. Because you will actually find that the more you try, the more you put effort in, the more tense the mind gets. And that's not just a way of meditation. You find that sometimes a way of life. As human beings, because of our education and our culture, we've been very well trained in being go-getters, being doers, being controllers. And unfortunately, that works some of the time, but some of the time it's counterproductive. We just get frustrated at anger, and sometimes even violence. And so some of the teachings which you have heard here today and put into practice and tried out, you'll find that they will give you the extra skill which is needed in life. That when there's nothing to do nothing. When there's something to do, to give everything you've got. We all know how to do that second one. When there's something to do, we can put enormous amounts of energy and resources into our work. But sometimes, that when there's nothing to do, we know there's nothing to do, we can't just stop and just let things work themselves out. So it's important to be able to learn this skill. Learn how to just leave things alone. And even if they look to be in crisis, even if terrible things are happening and it looks like it's going to get worse and worse and worse, just the ability just to stop and let go and to be at peace is an amazing skill. And sometimes it can save your life. One of those original stories in my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, told to me by one of the teachers where I was working as a school teacher for 1 year. He was the head of the English department in this school in the West Country of England. And it was a great story because it was from his own experience as a young man. He got he joined the army during the Second World War and was fighting in Burma, of all places. And fighting in Burma, he was with a small number of fellow soldiers when they just stumbled into a whole huge number of Japanese troops. Very quickly, they were totally surrounded. This was war. And so he thought that he was going to die. And he had a captain of his small group of soldiers. And the scout reported to the captain that we're completely surrounded, that they're heavily outnumbered, there is no way out. And of course, that would cause many people to have a lot of terror. But this man, this young man at the time, he was quite surprised at his reaction. Instead of terror, he thought the thing to do was to fight your way out. And even though the chances of anyone making it were so slim, it was a proper thing to do as a soldier to try and fight your way out. And anyway, you may be able to kill some of the enemy with you. So he was prepared to go for it, even though it was probably going to kill him. But his captain said no. He said, we won't fight our way out. Instead, he said, we'll all sit down and have a cup of tea. And this man thought, even though it's the British Army, this is going too far. How can you think of a cup of tea when you're at war? This is no joke. This is Second World War. in a foreign country, in Burma, surrounded by Japanese troops and about to lose your life. How on earth can anyone think of a cup of tea at this time? But the captain said, we're going to have a cup of tea. And in that time, in war, if you had that instruction, you had to follow orders. There was no choice. Even if there were crazy orders, you had to follow them. So he thought, this is absolutely idiotic. The guy's been out in the sun too long. But nevertheless, they sat down and tried to make themselves a cup of tea. And in the time it took them to make the cup of tea, before they had apparently finished drinking it, the scout came back and said, the enemy's moved. There's a way out. Put away your things quickly. Let's go. And they did go, and they escaped. That's why he could tell us a tale. No casualties, they all escaped. And he said, what a beautiful strategy that was. That when you're surrounded by enemy troops, it could be your husband having a go at you, it could be sort of the tax inspectors knocking on your door, it could be sort of the cancers which are sort of eating away your life force in your body. When you're surrounded by the enemy, what do most people do? They'll fight our way out. Even though if, you know, we die, we're going to take some of those tax inspectors with us. Whatever it is. And so, that is very often counterproductive. Instead, when there's nothing to do, when you're completely surrounded by the enemy, and it looks like it's going to be death or something worse, just sit down and have a cup of tea. To be able to learn how to do nothing when it looks like it's a life and death situation is a very, very skillful technique which can often save your life. When there's nothing to do, it's obvious to do nothing. But how many people can actually do that? If you were in that situation, would you be able to have a cup of tea when the enemy is around you? Now you may be able to, having done a meditation retreat. But a lot of times the mind gets so worried and upset, it just hasn't got that ability to let go and be still. So some of those techniques which you learn here are literally life-saving. Sometimes you may be on your deathbed and you're just laying down there. And so often I've been in that situation of counseling somebody while they're dying. And too many people struggle. And they fight for the last breath. And it's just so sad to watch because they die in pain and in fear. If they'd have only been to meditation retreats like this a few times, then they would know just how to let go. There's nothing to do. Fighting is a waste of time. You're going to die anyway. Just sit down and have a cup of tea, metaphorically. If you don't like tea, go and get yourself a plate of noodles. Or whatever else, you know, you like in life. You know, get a few hoppers or whatever. And just enjoy this moment instead of always fighting your way out. This is actually learning that technique of how to do nothing when there's nothing to do. But the point is that a lot of times people wait to the last moment. Again, very often, somebody's dying and they've only got like a few hours to live and they say, Hi Jan Bum, great, thank you goodness you've come, can you please teach me meditation? I think, my goodness, you should have come months ago, years ago, it's a bit late now, just when you've only got an hour or two to live and your body's pretty sore. So it's great to be able to learn these techniques while you are still able to learn them. So these are techniques. Learning how to let go, to relax, learning how to do nothing, and realizing just how much peace and how much energy it gives you. They can save your life. I think in Nolamara, and also in Armadale, there's many of these old stories which, you know, are in the back of your mind somewhere, and then they come up at the right time and place. That one of the fellow monks who I grew up with, he was an American monk from the Bronx, from a very rough area of New York. And he once told me the story of his sister. Actually, his sister actually wrote to him in Northeast Thailand. He showed me the letter. Because his sister was working in New York, and she had a small apartment somewhere. This was maybe 30 years ago. And she did a very, very stupid thing. She decided to do her laundry in the middle of the night. So she took the bag of laundry, went to one of these laundromats, these automatic laundry shops, and there she was, alone, a young woman, in the middle of the night, in a rough area of New York. And sure enough, this Afro guy came in, pulled out a gun, and told her to drop her skirt. She was about to be raped. And she wrote the letter, "Everything my mother told me to beware of, I forgot." And it was a split-second decision, quite a stupid thing to do. No, maybe, or maybe it wasn't. But she decided to make a run for it. So she ran out of the shop, and two bullets hit her in the back. He was shooting her. But fortunately, she managed to get into a doorway, bang on the door, and the very, very fortunate thing was that somebody opened that door. Usually that time of night, if you bang on a door in New York, even 30 years ago, no one would open it. We don't know who's on the other side. It's just too dangerous. But someone opened it, and so the third bullet missed her. And they called the ambulance, they got her to hospital, and she survived. When she wrote the letter, she said the doctors were amazed that she survived those injuries. They said 99% of the time people would have died from those bullet wounds. And she said the only thing which saved her, which kept her alive, so she could write the letter, was she knew how to meditate. She'd learned meditation from her brother when the brother was visiting New York. And when those bullets struck, when there was nothing to do, she just watched her breath and completely relaxed. I know now, I'm not the doctor, but every now and again people talk to me. And I always remember that something which I learned as a school teacher, because as a school teacher, especially if you're teaching science subjects, sooner or later some kid's going to put their finger in the electric socket or pour acid over top of them. Because, you know, kids being kids, and it's always accidents going to happen. So we insisted, say, can we get a doctor to come and teach us some basic first aid? And the one thing I always remember from that GP, like a very old English GP, he said the biggest killer is not the injuries, but the shock. That's actually the reaction you have to those injuries. And I always remember him telling us, if you see like a road accident or a kid has really injured themselves badly, you almost, he's told us, always lie. Always say, oh, it doesn't look so bad. Oh, you're going to make it. Even if you don't believe that. Simply because if someone's got an injury and you say, oh my God, look at that. You know what happens? And you go into shock. And it's a shock which kills most people, apparently. It's the reaction you have to those injuries. So, and I think that might be one time you may sort of bend that sort of fourth precept a little bit to save somebody's life. So if you see someone with a big wound or sort of in a car crash, always try and reassure them, just so they don't go into that shock. So, because of her meditation, she didn't go into shock, and that actually saved her life. So it's a wonderful thing to be able to do this practice of letting go, but you've got to do it now. Don't wait till you've been shot, or wait till you're on your deathbed. Which brings one of those wonderful stories to mind. And again, sometimes you overtell these stories, but I haven't told this story for a long time now. And it's the story of the old seaman and the professor. A long time ago, before we had Qantas and Singapore Airlines and all these other aircraft carriers, if a person wanted to go from one place to another, they had to go by ship. And this was happening to this professor, who was about to go to deliver a series of lectures in a prestigious university overseas. And so instead of flying, he was actually in a boat. Take a few days, but it's a nice, comfortable, easy way to travel. And after the first night at sea, he decided to go up on deck to take the air. And as he was walking on deck, he saw this old sailor. And being a quite genial professor, he decided to go and have a chat with the old sailor, just to, you know, something to say. So he sidled up to the old sailor, and he saw the sailor looking down into the waters. And he said, "Old man, how long have you sailed these oceans of our world?" And the old sailor said, "Ever since I was a young boy, 14. And I went to sea, and I've been at sea ever since." "Amazing," said the professor. "You know, in all those years at sea, you must have learnt a lot about the oceans underneath you, and the marine life in there, and the currents." He said, "You must be one of the experts on marine science." He said, "Actually, I don't know a thing about the oceans and the animals and stuff which live in there. Don't know a thing about that." "Really," said the professor, "that's a bit of a waste, isn't it? You spent all this life at sea, never bother to open a book and to learn about the oceans underneath you. That's a really waste of a life, you silly old man, he said. And he walked away, disgusted that a person could live their life on the oceans and never actually learn something about them. The next night at sea, it was a very nice dinner, and he was in a good mood. And so when he went on the deck again for a walk, he saw that old sailor and thought, oh, I'll give the guy a second chance. And so he went up to him, and this time the old man was looking at the heavens. It was one of these beautiful, clear nights. And the professor said, I'm sorry about last night, what I said to you, silly old man, because we can't know everything about everything. You know, actually, he said, my hobby is actually astronomy. And I know that, you know, this is before you had global positioning satellite systems. The only way you find out where you are in these wide oceans is actually by the stars above you. And that's how you navigate. He said, in all those years at sea, you must learn a lot about astronomy and the stars and how they all work together. And the old man said, don't know a thing about astronomy. Don't know one star from another, just a speck of light to me. What? Said the professor. What a waste of a life, you silly old man. All that life at sea, you never bothered to look at a book and find out even the names of what these things actually mean. Oh, you dummy. And he walked away, again, disgusted at the old man. The third night at sea, it was such a delicious meal from the cook that it didn't matter what happened before, he was just in a magnificent mood. And when you're in a good mood, you're very, very forgiving and accommodating. And this time when he walked up on deck, there was this beautiful breeze just wafting over the ocean. It was like a perfect night. And he went up to the old man and said, look, I'm sorry about the previous two nights. I know that sometimes, you know, it's the navigator's job, the captain's job, to actually worry about where you are. But one of the things which I know that you have to understand is about the weather. Because the weather actually drives your ship. And sometimes this is a big storm, you know, you can sink. When there's a nice breeze like this, you know that sometimes you're not going very fast, you have to take other plans. So the weather is so important to the old sailing ships. The professor says, actually, you know what? I am a professor of meteorology. I'm just going to go to the United States to give a lot of lectures on meteorology. And you know, I think it'd be a great thing if I can pick your brain, because you've been at sea for such a long time. You've experienced these typhoons or cyclones that have been calmed, and you know the winds, which way they come, and what the signs are, there's going to be a storm. He said, yes, but from your experience, you probably know as much as I do about meteorology. And the old sailor said, what? What? Meteorology, the weather. How's that? No, I don't know anything about the weather. What? Said the professor, all those years at sea. You don't know about the winds and how they work and just how storms arise and what the signs are. I said, nope, nothing about that. And that was the last straw. You stupid old man. All those years and you never learned anything about the world around you. What a waste. A complete waste of a life, you dummy. And he went away muttering, ah, just what a waste of a life. What a waste of a life. What a waste of a life. The fourth night, he never went on deck. He never even had any dinner, because that night there was a storm. And you know what it's like if the boat is rocking backwards and forwards? People very easily get seasick. And he was one of those people, if he even rocked a little bit, sometimes even in the bath he got seasick. So I just make these things up. So he never went out to have any dinner. He just stayed in his cabin all night. And as the night wore on, the storm got worse and worse. It got more and more violent, and the boat started to rock more and more precariously. He had to tie his things down or put them in his suitcase, because things were rolling off the shelves. And his bed was going up and down. And it was getting really, really violent. And he could hear these creaks and cracks of the wooden ship, and he started to get very afraid. As you would do, because where's there to go? And his fear reached a peak of terror when he heard a loud bang, followed by people running outside his cabin door. He quickly got up, and just so afraid, he opened the cabin door, and who was running outside? But the old sailor. And the old seaman stopped. And he looked at the professor and said, "If you don't mind me asking, Professor, in all your years, have you ever learned how to swim?" The professor said, "Actually, no, I can't swim." "What a waste of a life," said the sailor. The ship is sinking. And the moral of that story, that came from Joseph Goldstein. I don't know where he got it from, but it's a great story. The moral of that story, if you're going to go sailing, it's okay to know about the weather, it's okay to know about astronomy, it's okay to know about marine science, but the most important thing to know if you're sailing is how to swim. So, if you are a human being and living a life, the most important thing to know is how to keep your head above water when your ship sinks. And you know in life it sinks very often, and sometimes you drown. So the most important thing to do is to learn how to swim while you have the time. Otherwise, when something goes wrong, you've got a cancer, your wife leaves you, your husband's run away with another woman. And when your finances are really terrible, and when I go back to my monastery and found all the monks have converted to being Christians, when everything just goes completely wrong, you might have it when you go back to Dhammasara. Sister Wayama might be a Muslim now. Who knows? When everything goes completely wrong, so that's when you have to learn how to keep your head above water. How to be able to meditate, to let go. If you can't do anything, just leave it alone and be at peace. So what you've learned here today is like survival skills. How to survive your life, because things don't always go the way they should, and very often they go wrong, and unexpected things happen, and that's our life, so we have to learn how to swim. In other words, something to do. Everything you've got, give it. Nothing you can do, just have a cup of tea and let go. Be at peace. Sometimes you also know that things change by themselves. How many days have we been here? 9 days? So fast. It was only yesterday I gave the first talk. It was only almost a moment ago you sort of got your room and settled in. And soon we'll be going. But don't worry. In a short time there'll be the next retreat in Easter. And just you'll be back here again. Don't worry. Soon you'll be in your coffin. You know, they've probably already made it now. It's probably sitting in some sort of warehouse somewhere. You don't know it, but it's got your name. So these things, they just pass away. So why are you so worried about such things for? So the point of the matter is, this is something we do, we can do it, but it's inevitable. Most of anger and frustration and suffering is having unrealistic expectations of life. And you've learnt some of that as well. I know some of you may have come in here saying, right, this is it. I've come all this way. I've come all the way from Sydney or from Melbourne, or even I've come all the way from overseas. And I know Ajahn Brahm teaches jhana. So I'm going to get jhana. I'm going to get it, okay? You focus your mind like in his motivational seminars. You imagine jhana. Imagine jhana. Imagine jhana. And I'm going to do it. I can do it. Other people can do it. Why can't I? You motivate yourself. And of course, that's called unrealistic expectations. And it's the unrealistic expectations which cause us suffering in life. It's like people who follow soccer or cricket or AFL. The unrealistic expectation is your team will win every game. It's obviously stupid, but people get very disappointed when they lose. Only one team can come top. It's the same, many of you have had unrealistic expectations of your children. You want them to go to university. And only a fraction of people can go to university. There's only one person in every class can come top. But you want that to be your kid. If you do, you're not a Buddhist. A Buddhist? What do Buddhists believe in? Middle way. So you tell your children, just come in the middle somewhere. And then you're a good Buddhist. If you come to the top or the bottom, that's the extremes. That's no good. That's not a Buddhist. You're not following the way of the Buddha. So tell your children to get in the middle somewhere, and then you're the real Buddhist. The ones who come top, the smart addicts, or the dummies at the bottom, they're not real Buddhists. Actually, I told that story when I was a school teacher. It fits in here, and many of you know it. When I was a school teacher, only for 1 year, at the end of that year, you had to sort of give out the report cards. And with the grading of the kids in the class, about 30 kids in the class, and of course one of the kids came bottom. One child has to come bottom. There's reason. So when this kid got his report card and started reading it and found he'd come bottom, I looked at him, his jaw dropped. And he looked, you know, suicidal, basically. He'd have to take this report card home to his parents. And he was terrified. And he was so upset and disappointed. And even then, I was a very compassionate young man. And so I thought, oh, poor kid. I can imagine what it's like having the report your 30th. It's not just with your parents, your friends in the class. You know, you're the bottom of the class, the dummy. And that must feel really, really terrible. You lose all your self-esteem. You really get depressed. You're afraid of what your parents might do and the privilege they'll take away. So I decided to be kind to that young man. I went up to him and I started teaching him some Buddhism. I started teaching him like some Mahayana. I said, in Mahayana, there's a concept called the Bodhisattva. And they're very well respected. They're worshipped in that part of Buddhism. And what this word Bodhisattva means is a person who sacrifices their own happiness and well-being for the sake of others. They'll give everything so another person will not suffer and be happy. He said, that's you. You've taken this terrible position at bottom of the class so that no one else in this class will have to experience the pain, the ignominy, and all of the threats from their parents if you don't work hard next year. So you've taken that on yourself to protect other people in this class. Oh, you are just such a hero. You sacrifice your own happiness for the sake of these other 29 children by becoming bottom. If anyone deserves a medal in this class, it's you. You are the Bodhisattva. In Buddhism, we praise people like you who come bottom so no one else will have to experience that. And he looked upon me as if I was crazy. But at least he laughed, and that sort of broke his depression. But there was some truth in that. Someone has to come bottom, so what's the big deal? The point of that story is, in this meditation retreat, where did you come? How was the report card? So the person in this retreat who had the worst meditation, who did the least amount of sitting and the most amount of sleeping, who ate the most toast in the morning, that you are the Bodhisattva. You are the ones we praise. Because you took that rotten position of the dummy of this meditation retreat so no one else would have to experience that. And all you people who got jhanas or got these nice nimittas, all the smart Alex, you forgot the middle way. The ones in about the middle there, you're the one to be praised the most. The point is again there, you see all this judging, the top and the bottom. What does it all mean anyway? The top or the bottom. How can you actually judge anybody when you know where a person comes from? Some people have been meditating for years. Some people are coming for the very first time. Some people have had past karma, they've been into jhanas and wonderful things, they've got incredible good spiritual qualities. Some are just, you know, walked in from the, as some of my monks say, we just became monks, we walked in from the nightclub, literally, into your monastery. So, you know, you've got a lot of old karma to work through before they can even get to the average stage. So we don't judge. Instead, we just learn. We accept. And we learn. But no judging. So the end of this retreat, they don't care what you've achieved, what you haven't achieved. That's not the point. It's how much you've let go is the point. As Ajahn Chah said, and I've told this to you many times, meditation is not to attain something, it's to learn how much we can let go of. How much we can abandon. All that judging, all that grading. Great retreat, terrible retreat. The worst retreat I've ever had in my whole life. I'm never coming here again. Or the best retreat which I've ever experienced. Wow, I'm going to sign up now for the next one. When is it? All of those are just too much judging. Instead, we learn how much we can abandon, how much we can let go. And that is the path of peace, contentment in meditation. It's the spiritual path which leads to enlightenment. And it's also the helpful technique for you to use in your daily life. Not all the time. Sometimes you have to use effort and exert yourself to plan, even to recall the past. That's what happens in life. But you've been on retreat here, you've been learning that part of life, that particular skill, which is important in your spiritual life, but is also one of the skills which you can use in your worldly life. How to relax and let go. For example, one of those skills which you learnt is that silent present moment awareness. And that is so helpful in your business and also in your relationships. How many times when people come to me and they're about to separate and get divorced, how many times they say, he's not listening to me. She doesn't understand what I'm going through. Why? They're telling each other. The only trouble is, no one is listening. The idea of silent present moment awareness, I also call that total listening. Because if someone is speaking to you, and you're thinking inside, and having a commentary, you're not fully listening. He's trying to say something, and you think, here he goes again. I've heard this so many times. When will he ever shut up? What's actually happening there? You're not listening to him at all. You're listening to your commentary. And that's why the message doesn't go through. It's the same when he listens to you. Sometimes you're telling him. He says, she's just in a bad mood. I don't want to listen to this. Why does she have to load this onto me now? Again, you're listening to your negativity. You're listening to your commentary. You're not listening to what she's saying. When you have total listening, silent present moment awareness, you're just there in the moment. You're not trying to take notes. You're allowing everything to soak in. You find you hear what the other person is saying. Sometimes you don't listen to the words. You listen to the sentences, the feelings, the tone. And that conveys as much as the words do. And sometimes even more. When you're total listening, you become a communicator. Someone who can understand what other people say. Deeply. Imagine what a social and a business skill that is. Sometimes people even think you've got psychic powers. You can read their mind. You don't need to read another person's mind. They tell you everything you need to know. If you're silent and you really listen, you can pick up so much. Being able to do that is a great skill in having a relationship, whether it's with your partner or with your kids or with your parents or with your customers or with your bosses or anyone else you work with. Be able just to be still and listen. To be passive. To suppress this doer which always wants to react and judge immediately without allowing all the data to come in. You just sit still. Or stand still, whatever else you're doing. Listen. Silently, no commentary. Amazing how that helps you. I said I've started getting into like a business guru circuit now, giving talks at conferences. And that's just some of the things I teach people in business, to learn how to listen to their customers or listen to their CEO, to understand what they're really saying. And if you can do that, it's amazing just the information and the power you have. Because knowledge is power, and knowledge comes from listening, not from thinking. So these are great techniques which can help you in your life. So you carry on learning what you've learned here. Not only does it lead to enlightenment, but it leads to success in life as well. And success in your relationships. The training of meditation as you learn it here will empower you. And that's why we teach it. It's not just for jhanas. It's not just for enlightenment, because it does those things. But on the way, it also gives you these other enormous tools. And let alone the health benefits which you get from meditation. Just being able to relax and let go. Things start to heal. And you feel more relaxed. The blood pressure goes down. The food tastes more beautiful. There's so many benefits. And as I mentioned in some of the interviews, one of the professors at Harvard who specialises in the physical effects of meditation has noticed your cortex gets thicker. In other words, you have more gigabytes in your brain. It's true, and they found that. So you become a smarter person. So, it'd be great to get all our kids to learn how to meditate. Because, Jhana, if you meditate more, you'll find that your grades will go up at school because you're getting a bigger brain. So that's true. So your brain has expanded quite a lot since you've been here. So that makes the schoolwork much easier. So, these are just some of the advantages of why we meditate. But, we also got to say now, well, it's easy to meditate here on this retreat because everything's nice and supportive and you can get sort of people giving you nice talks and the interviews whenever you get wrong. You've held your, had your hand held during this retreat, taking you here, taking you there. And the food is very nice. You've got nothing to do. You can sleep whenever you want. You try and get away with that at home. No way. Get up! Your wife says, it's time to go to work. No, no, Ajahn Brahm taught me how to let go. That just doesn't wash with your wife. Yeah, got to go and do something. No, nothing to do, do nothing. No, don't be like. So it's very difficult in life, living like this. So how are you going to manage when you get back home into that busy world? And of course, if you really find value in meditation, you always find time for it. Because we notice if it's your favorite movie or your favorite TV program. I know before quite a few people I knew in the Buddhist society really liked The Bill, the TV series. And so sometimes, you know, you'd say, you know, can you sort of help the monks and write, oh, sorry, I'm busy. Gotta watch The Bill. Or if you did sort of go and see them, they put the recording on so they could see it later. They would always be able to find time for their most favorite TV program. Or sometimes it might be, I think, was it last year or a couple of years ago, they had the World Cup soccer. And that was in the middle of the night. But still people would find time to get up in the middle of the night and watch it. You ask them to get up in the middle of the night to actually meditate. Oh, no way. I'll be tired when I go in the morning. Yeah, what about the soccer? Oh, no, it's different. So the point is that if it's really important to you, you will always find the time. So, hopefully, I've brainwashed you enough. My marketing is strong enough that now you'll realize that meditation makes this amazing product called you. You are brighter, cleaner, shinier as a result of the meditation. And because of that, you will buy that product every morning. You will go onto your seat and say, meditation is good. And actually is good. You don't need to be a marketer because it's got a very, very, very good reputation. It does work. So you have to find the time. Now one of the troubles is that because people don't see the value of meditation, they think, well, you know, I'll sort of, you know, get this letter written first. Get it out of the way, then I'll meditate. Well, I have my breakfast first and then I'll meditate. Well, yeah, next breakfast done. Well, you know, I've got to sort of listen to the news. I'll listen to that first and then I'll meditate. Well, I'll do something else. And meditation gets put on the end of the agenda. And in order to emphasize that story, that in the interviews, one of the retreatants here told me a very, very funny story about the monkey mind. And I'm going to adapt that in order to emphasize the point. Because once upon a time, there was a monkey who was visiting the retreat center, looking for some snack left over by the retreatants. And as he was sitting in the tree, he heard the monk start to give the talk. And he heard the word, monkey mind. And he thought, I'm a monkey, what's this all about? You must apply to me. And he heard this monk talk about the monkey mind, always jumping here, always jumping there, never being still. Now, always being restless, and he was actually really calling the monkey mind something really awful, like a defilement, a hindrance, something you should try and get rid of. And the monkey mind was one of the lowest minds according to these human beings. And that monkey, hearing the monkey mind was no good, was really offended. So what's wrong with a monkey mind? I'm a monkey. That's not on. I've just been insulted by the monk. And so he went back to his troop and complained. You can hear what these human beings say about us and our minds. They say it's terrible, it's a defilement, it's a cause for all the suffering. The monkey mind causes dukkha. It's not dukkha, I'm happy being a monkey. We monkeys, we've been insulted, we're being slandered. We shouldn't stand for this. We should stand up for our monkey mind rights. And so he's very, very upset. So all the monkeys said, yeah, you got a point there. You know, that this is like, not racism, it's like speciesism. They think their mind is so good and monkey minds are so terrible. But monkey minds are okay. You can't do this, not in our modern world. There's an infringement on our rights to enjoy our mind, which belongs to our species, and you shouldn't sort of degrade it or sort of slander it. It's okay, it's good. Monkey mind is beautiful. And they were jumping up and down complaining. And when the old monkey said, look, calm down, look, it's obviously what they're talking about. What are you doing jumping up and down? That's what a monkey mind. No wonder the human beings sort of criticize us and insult us. So they've got good grounds to insult us. He said, know what we should really do? We should change our habits so monkeys will be peaceful. When monkeys are peaceful and stop jumping up and down and not so restless, that when human beings talk about a monkey mind, they'll talk about a peaceful mind. And then actually it will make us feel good, and so we won't be insulted anymore because it doesn't fit us anymore. Because we're only actually noticing what's actually true. We have got a problem. We jump up and down too much. So all the old monkeys said, yeah, there's a lot of sense in that. Sometimes people criticize you, and instead of sort of telling the person, no, you're insulting me, there's something wrong with you, you should actually change first of all, then they wouldn't insult you. So the monkey said, yeah, okay, fair enough. You know, our monkey minds are a bit restless. So what should we do? And the old monkey said, look, what human beings do is they meditate. They sit down for an hour and they just watch their breath or they watch nimittas or whatever they do and they become very peaceful, very calm. Once we're very peaceful, very calm, when human beings look at monkeys, they will never call a monkey mind something terrible and awful anymore. The old monkey said, yeah, great idea. Let's learn how to meditate. So they all went into the trees and in the bushes and they got some nice grass to make zafus. Some of them, they decided to make little wooden chairs to sit on. Others leant against a tree because they like leaning against the wall. And there's always some smart asses who pulled out some stones and decided to specially sit on hard stones. There's always, as monkeys, so human beings. And they started to meditate. After about 2 or 3 minutes, one of them interrupts, say, excuse me. And everyone had to open their eyes again. So what is it? He said, you know, after we finish this hour of meditation, we all planned we're going to eat. It's going to be lunchtime. And we all decided we're going to raid this plantation, the banana plantation. Why don't we get out of the way, first of all? Let's go to the plantation, get the bananas. So it means after we come out of meditation, we don't have to waste any time. We can actually eat after we meditate. And Mike said, yeah, it's a good idea. So they all got off their zafus and they went over to the banana plantation, collected all these bananas and put them in the middle of their little meditation area. Said, okay, we've got the bananas, now let's do our meditation. So they all sat down there and they started to meditate, watching their breath. After 2 minutes, one of the monkeys said, excuse me. Said, no. So after you finish our meditation, we don't have to collect the bananas now, we've already got them. But before we eat them, we have to peel them. Let's peel them now, get it out of the way. And once that's out of the way, then we can meditate. So when we finish meditation, we don't have to waste time, we can actually just eat straight away. And they're all, great idea. So they all peel their bananas and put them in a big pile. I say, okay, let's meditate again. Come on, watch the breath, going in, going out. After 2 minutes, excuse me. So they all have their eyes again. And one of the monkeys said, you know, before we actually eat these, we've got to put them in our mouth. So let's put them in our mouth now. We won't eat them, we just put them in our mouth. So as soon as we finish meditation, we don't have to waste time. Good idea, said all the monkeys. So they've all got a couple of bananas each. Some got three so they could fit it in their mouth. They stuffed their mouth. They didn't eat it, because this was meditation time. And a couple of minutes later, all the bananas were gone. They'd eaten them. And that was the time the bell went for the end of the meditation. And that was, Somia told me that story, but I did adapt it a little bit. And what it means is, why is it we always try and get things out of the way before we meditate? We'll just do this, and then we'll meditate. We'll just collect the bananas, we'll peel them, we'll even stuff them in our mouth, and then we'll meditate, realizing that that is the monkey mind. So, how many of you have packed all your bags now? You monkeys! We'll just pack our bags first, get that out of the way, then we can meditate. You can see what a monkey mind really is, and why it is that we get these things all out of the way. And what we're actually doing, we're getting our meditation out of the way. We're getting our life out of the way. And when you realize what you're doing, that's very terrifying. How much of your life have you got out of the way already? A heap of it. I'll get this out of the way, then I'll do something, what I really want to do. And soon you're 60 or 70, and you wonder why you're not wise, why nothing has happened in life. Because you've been getting every moment, every hour, days, weeks, months, years out of the way. Just like those monkeys, we'll put these bananas in our mouth and then we'll meditate. So be very careful. If you know the important things in life, you give those priority. And you give meditation. Get meditation out of the way first of all. And then you can go and collect your bananas. They'll still be there. Meditate first. You can pack your bags at the last minute. You'll be able to do it. So every time you're on this retreat, you don't give even a moment away. Every moment counts. So the retreat doesn't finish until exactly 1:45. 25 minutes and 1 second. No, 15 minutes and 1 second to 2. You are still on retreat until the very last second. And that way, you get as much as you possibly can out of life. You don't throw minutes and hours out of the way, getting things out of the way before you can really meditate. So that way that we learn from this, just how important life is, and how we should really be living our life, and what we should be doing. And if you can do that, you not only have huge amounts of progress on your spiritual life, you will also have huge amounts of progress in your material life as well. The two go together. I mentioned this earlier, I've been mentioning it a lot because it's another of those great psychological surveys which has been done. It wasn't just in the US, apparently it was in Europe as well, where this sociologist, or psychologist I think it was, wanted to find out what comes first, success or happiness. Is it the case that successful people are happy, or that happy people are successful? And they were quite surprised that the evidence was so conclusive that happiness comes first and then success, not the other way around. So if you're a happy person, you learn how to let go and be peaceful and have fun, then you become successful. Whether you're a monk, or whether you're a tax collector, whether you are a cricketer, or whatever else it is, it's the happy people are the successful ones. So by learning how to meditate, you're learning about the secret of happiness, the Four Noble Truths. Why, when you crave, I want, you don't get happiness, and when you really let go, you relax, you get lots of happiness. So, by coming here and having a good time, relaxing in Club Med, you're knowing the secret of success. Happy people become successful. Misery guts, grumpy people, they're always at the bottom of the pile. So, be careful. What type of person do you want to be? And this is a secret to your success. Understanding that also means that this meditation is important to your worldly life, your successful life as a mother, as a father, as a wife, as a husband, anything. The happiness is so important because it energizes you. Not only energizes you, it encourages you, so you participate in things, whether it's the mind, you engage with the meditation or you engage with the work. If you have to wash up, you engage with it instead of trying to get this out of the way, I don't need to do this. But you engage with it because you're happy no matter what you ever do, and that is the secret to success. So that you have learnt on this retreat what some people go to the Hilton or the Sheraton and pay thousands of dollars for just one weekend. And the only difference between me and those gurus is they have sharp suits and hairstyles, and I've only got this old brown robe and a sort of scrappy head. And that's the only difference. But you learn exactly the same, actually even better than you learn in these motivational seminars. So it's very lucky you're here. So hopefully you've enjoyed this retreat. But remember, it's not over yet. It was Ananda, the last moment he became enlightened, just before he joined in this big ceremony. And so often that's the case. The last moment is the best. People usually get paid just as they're leaving work. And if they get the paycheck an hour early before they're supposed to leave, they leave anyway. So, the paycheck is coming just at the last moment. So remember to be alert, to be mindful. Because when the fellow or the lady, the postman with the check comes, if you're not in, if you don't answer the door when they knock because you're somewhere else, then they'll go and give your paycheck to somebody else. So be alert and be careful. And that's how we can meditate. So hopefully you've enjoyed this retreat and can enjoy the last few hours. After I've finished here, I'm going to ask a few questions. I'm going to spend another hour in the interview room, and anyone can come in there until 10 o'clock if you've got anything you want to say. Any last minute questions? I'll be in there with one of the other monks. But after around about 10 o'clock, I want to come in here and meditate with you all for the very end. And after lunch, 11 o'clock, you can clean up again. Come in at 1 o'clock. And at 1 o'clock, we do a meditation and finish off with a metta meditation and chanting to finish off this retreat. Is that all quite clear? Okay. Anyone got any questions about what's been said? It's your last chance for questions. There's no question time tonight. Yeah. In Easter, yes. We're going to do another meditation retreat here in Easter. The places, they fill up very quickly. So you have to be on the ball, sharp. Sometimes have contacts who can actually book it in for you at the right time. Sometimes people do. We used to sort of have these forms which you would have to fill in. And the forms were only available sort of, I think, was it a week or 2 weeks before the retreat. But somebody was very, very clever. They got one form for one of the retreats and they copied them all on the photocopier. So they had all the forms filled out, ready, at every retreat. So sometimes people are very, very smart and clever, so you've got to hand it to them. So that's, I think it's Thursday, is it 2nd of April? 6th of April to the 14th. 6th to the 14th of April, that will be in here. And there's another one next November, but I'm not quite sure whether I'll be teaching that one in November, because... Do you know that fourth global conference on Buddhism, which we did here, the fifth global conference is going to be in Kuala Lumpur, KL. And the last I heard, they were putting conference on right on one of those weekends for the November retreat. So I'm not quite sure how we can manage that. We'll see what happens anyway. But then afterwards, the year after, in 2008, we can have heaps of retreats because we'll have our own retreat center, hopefully. And that's why my marketing... people have been outside, putting the plans outside and the brochures. So if you can't afford any donations yourself, maybe you might know somebody who needs to make some good karma so you can take the brochures away with you. So that's for our retreat center, which was coming up soon. Hopefully, it should be in 2008. And that means it's much easier. I made sure that some of the design features in the retreat center is the walls are going to be smooth. So you can actually lean against them without these little bricks poking up into your back. Because these bricks, they look very nice, but they're not good for leaning against. Another little feature. But if you want to have a look, I've got the plans outside. I left them there so you can have a look and see what the retreat center is going to look like. And the view, it's not an aerial view. Where I usually put the interview list is not an aerial view. I call it the levitator's eye view of our retreat center. Because that's what it will look like, you know, after you've meditated and risen about 20 feet in the air because of levitation. There's a levitator's eye view of our retreat centers out there as well. It looks very flash. When I took that plan over to Singapore, they looked and said, it's very, very good, Ajahn Brahm. There's only one thing missing. I said, what's that? He said, the golf course. Because sometimes that's what it looks like, a bit like a resort, and they should have a golf course around the corner. But we've done it that way simply because I know it's important you have comfort when you meditate. Sitting long enough gives you aches and pains. And especially that for people who've got cancers or people who are very old or sick. So it's important that we make a retreat center which can accommodate especially those people who need it the most, the elderly and the sick. Because in my life, too many retreat centers have been great when you're fit and healthy and young. But you know, if you're not, then it's a bit tough. And so a lot of times, elderly people or sick people say, I'd like to come, but I don't think I can enjoy it physically. And my dream is, if we get enough funds, we'll employ a butler for every retreatant. Who will take your orders in the morning. Madam, what would you like for breakfast? Fantasy. Okay, anyway. That is only a joke, because I don't think anyone could do that. But you never know. Yes, me. That's only about another 1 minute. If you ever look at those brochures, we did those in July, and I think at that time we had 1.6 million. Now we've got about 1.9 million. Actually, over 1.9. So it's getting there. And I know I said before, why did Ajahn Brahm, you know, you're a good meditator, why don't you take the whole lot down to Birdswood Casino? Surely you'd be able to make up the extra million in 10 minutes. But of course, that would be the wrong message. I'll probably lose it all and have to disappear very quickly. So, but any other questions about the meditation or what I've been saying here? Okay, so now's the time. Don't pack. Don't go collecting the bananas. And put them in your mouth. Meditate first. You can collect the bananas after lunch. You have plenty of time to pack afterwards. So thank you, Sonia, for that story. It's a very good story. So please meditate and enjoy this morning, because this is still retreat time. And I should actually mention that after 11 o'clock, if you want to start talking, the noble silence is probably already broken, but nevertheless, it's officially broken at lunchtime. So 11 o'clock, if you want to sort of say hello to each other, there's people you've been seeing all the time. You don't have to. If you'd rather not speak, you can still put your finger up against your mouth and just be even more silent. But if you want to actually speak and actually chat to people, how you've been, what's been going on, because we leave at 1:45 or about 2 o'clock, and sometimes when people leave, they just leave, bang, they're all gone. And sometimes it's nice to have a little bit of fellowship with the people you've shared this week with. And so sometimes, if you want to have a little bit of a chat, from 11 o'clock onwards, you can start. But you don't have to. If you'd rather be peaceful, take your food a long way away, where it's nice and quiet. Yeah?
I'm collecting these
things, yes. Yeah? Are we? We are, okay, yeah. Sorry, but if you really, really, really want one, you can always ask me. Because I can always fix things. Me and Mr. Burke. Okay, very good. So, I'll be in the room for the next hour. So have a nice, meditate, and again, remember, don't collect the bananas. Meditate instead. Good story.